I would like to know when and where you each were when you first heard Love Light on the radio. Owen?
Well, I'll tell you, and I don't know if anybody remembers, I'm sure you remember this, but the first time that we really heard it, I was sitting in Porky's.
With who?
I know it was with Lauren and a couple of other people. And we were sitting in Porky's, and the record came on, and somebody in the car said, shh, shh, shh. And everybody in Porky's, all the cars had it playing. And I remember specifically there was some cute girls next to us and rolling down the window and saying, that's us. And they were like, yeah. And they rolled their window back up again. Sure. Right. Good to see you. But I specifically remember being in Porky's and hearing it, and every car was playing our song. They all had it turned up. It was really a cool, almost like out of a movie kind of a scene.
Was that Porky's on Lake Street?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were there all the time.
Well, the one near Lake Calhoun.
Oh, yeah. It was with Rick.
There was a golf course behind.
I think so. I'm kind of fuzzy, but I believe we were at Porky's. I think so.
All right. Who else wants to jump in on the first time?
Okay, the first time I heard Love Light, I was driving my MGA convertible along with Rick Levinson, and we were either on our way to or from B-Sharp Music, on our way to B-Sharp, yeah. And it was quite phenomenal to hear it. There wasn't anybody around to tell it to.
Top was down. It was like 75 degrees. It was a perfect night. Sitting in the MGA red convertible, and all of a sudden the song comes on the radio. Life did not get any better than it was at that moment.
No, it's really, it nice. Does, it yeah. never gets any
at
better.
At that moment, it was peak. And a car pulls up next to us at the stop sign, and I go, hey, that's us. And you got the same response. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Doug?
Well, I was going to the weather. You know, for those listening that don't know, Minneapolis and St. Paul are a city of lakes, and I was going around Lake Calhoun. It was absolutely gorgeous weather, and to have this song blow through that beautiful little 4 or 5 inch speaker.
was that your triumph?
It was. I think so. It was either that or I had the band van. I'm not sure. Okay. And to hear that was just really blew me away. It was awesome. You know, you're driving by looking at all these people going, if they only knew, right here.
How about you, Bears?
I was riding, it was at night, and I was at a stoplight at Excelsior Boulevard and Highway 100, and I was with Bill Brisley, who was later the bass player in Dave Brady and the Stars. And it came on, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's kind of a surreal feeling when you're listening to what you know as yourself on the radio. And Bill got so excited, he jumped out of the car. He started running around to the cars around us at the stoplight saying, my friend's on the radio! It was really bizarre, but a lot of fun.
What kind of band vehicle did the High Spirits have?
They had a 40 Connelline.
Do you know what year it was?
It's fairly new.
It was used with about 15,000 miles on it. We got it, but we got a good deal on it.
Yeah.
And
maybe
it was
a year old.
Tan.
Right.
It was ugly tan.
Yeah.
But then Lopez paid for the paint job if we would put instruments courtesy of B-Sharp on the back of it.
Yeah.
And you obviously had the High Spirits name on there.
Yeah.
So it went from tan to red.
Yeah.
We started in tan
and then we
with the lettering, and then we changed
then
it to red with white lettering.
Yeah.
Okay, now you brought up B-Sharp, and I'm glad you did, because at this point in time, I would like to know what type of instruments everybody was playing. Owen, you want to start?
Well, my first instrument was the one I traded my clarinet for, and that was a Sears Silvertone guitar, red. And I just remember that the strings were so high off of you could slice salami on it because the strings were so high off the fretboard that you had to really like press so hard to do that. And then I think after seeing David Rifkin's guitar, I somehow found out about B-Sharp and went down there and bought.
You had that white guitar, right?
No, I had the white one. He had the blue, metallic blue Fender Jazzmaster.
Yeah, that's a
that probably came. That probably came later from, you know, from B Sharp. I think subsequent to that, we all got free instruments from B Sharp.
You bought a 335 Cherry Red.
Yeah.
I bought a 335.
That was Sunburst. My second guitar.
My second guitar was a 335 Sunburst, and then I got the Rickenbacker after that.
Yeah,
Rick,
I remember
what
that.
What did Rick have?
Rick played his, what, your precision bass?
Yeah, so I had, when I was playing in the Treble Man, I had a Sears bass, and Bob Cohen and Randy Resnick called my dad, and they said, look, you got to get him better equipment. So he said, well, what do I do? And they said, well, we found one. So I got a 62 Fender precision bass at B Sharp. My dad drove me over there, and he said, this is courtesy of your friends.
Really?
Gave me this, yeah.
Do you still have it?
No.
You know what that would be worth?
I wish I did. Yeah, I know.
Worth a fortune.
That was pre-CBS.
Yeah. And Doug, you had a silver drum set, right?
Well, I started with a navy blue Sparkle Slingerland that was the house drums from a famous dance hall called Birdland on the East Coast.
Really?
Yep, I had those courtesy of...
Owned by Morris Levy.
As courtesy of Elliot Fine, my drum teacher. And then I went to a copper colored set of Gretsch is what I played
dark
with
copper.
Dark copper, which is a very pretty drum. So that I played with this band for the first few years. And then I was sponsored after that by B Sharp and Rogers, and I played silver Rogers drums is what I ended up playing with over the years.
Jay, what kind of keyboards were you on now at this point in time?
I was playing a Farfisa organ. I bought my first Farfisa from B Sharp. Upgraded a couple times. Every time I upgraded, there was no charge, which was nice. So I played Farfisa the whole time.
Okay.
And later on, I had a Leslie speaker that I used with it that improved it quite a
bit.
Which
was great. Sound. Yeah. By the way, if you remember, we had B Sharp on the side of that truck.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's... We made an agreement with him that he would either give us stuff or we maybe trade
it. Yeah, I traded it in. Yeah.
He gave us great deals and our trades, you know, would upgrade us and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So the band parts ways with Rick London, and you came and hooked up with Path Productions. How did that come about?
Dick and Ira were the main booking agents for the dance halls. With the exception of Mr. Lucky's, they supplied band talent for all the dance halls in the area. And they were the ones also contacted most frequently for the fraternity parties and the university parties and the this and the that. So he had access to more jobs. And Ira, being a Heilitzer, had access to his dad's ear for records. And he was a record producer because he had done Little Latin Loopy Lou for the Chancellors. So for us, it was a natural. Plus... We knew them, pre-existing friendship, and Ira lived a half a block from me, and Dick lived two blocks from me on the same block. So it was just natural.
And you know that the path is Park and North. That was the for North High because Ira was North, and I think Dick was Park. So that's how Path came about. And you know what? They were the real deal. I mean, they were doing it for real. I don't know when Marsh came along, but that was
later. Afterwards.
Came along later. And I remember once that everybody ran over to Marsh when Marsh came along. And our decision was to stay with Dick because if everybody ran over to Marsh, then we would be left with all the gigs
we
that
got
Dick
the focus.
Still have. And we got the focus. I mean, it was a smart move.
What kind of clothes did the High Spirits wear on stage?
We started out with seersucker suits. I remember
sweater
that.
Vests.
And paisleys. We wore a lot of paisley, except for Lauren, who always dressed differently. And I remember...
No, I really dressed differently.
Well, that's why we're still relevant. So, but I remember that we had these seersucker suits, and then we sort of got more into... We wore red paisley shirts with white cuffs. I remember that picture.
Actually, there was a period between the two where we went to wearing whatever you want to wear.
Right.
each person just dressed how they wanted to dress for that.
And we kind of rolled into the British mod rocker thing.
And what was that store downtown Minneapolis where everybody was buying?
It was Carnaby Street was in the arcade. Right?
Everybody was at the arcade, and we went down and bought our you know, our little English little duds there. And then after that, when psychedelia came in, then we were all in these kind of psychedelic. I remember my girlfriend at the time had sewed together all. I still have all those outfits stored in Heilitzer's. And I had all, it was went from the cute little paisley shirts to these wild Hendrix-y kind of things.
So what were some of the clubs that the High Spirits played at?
Well, I think three of my favorite places were Dance Land. Of course, that was always fun. And it seemed like every time we played Dance Land, it was always Battle of the Bands with someone. I remember TC Atlantic. I remember the Underbeats. And it was just, those were really fun. The second place that I really remember, because it was the first dance hall I ever went to, was the Marion Ballroom in
Bloomington.
Yeah. And later on down 494, they had, what was that called?
The Barn.
But over Safari in Mendota, Club. There was a place called Bobby's, and that was another really fun place. The one that was one of my favorites was the Waconia Ballroom.
Oh, yeah. And,
you remember the Cow Palace in South St. Paul near the stockyards?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Wakota Ball. That was an ice skating.
It was an arena.
They called that the Wakota Arena.
Yeah.
And that was
Was that what that was?
Yeah. That was a...
The two stages I like. I like the Marigold Ballroom downtown, the Hyatt Regency.
I love the Marigold.
Had that great big stage.
Yeah.
Remember, there was a big triple battle of the bands: Gregory Dee and the Ivanis, the Chancellors, and the High Spirits one night, and that was like the big event of the summer because all three big bands, you know, were playing the same night. And the other stage that I really liked was the Cato Ballroom in Mankato.
Oh yeah.
Remember, sort of undulating. It was carpeted. It was soft. And it was a very cool stage.
Did you play the Prom Center too?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we played the Prom. I like that. That was a real professional kind of stage and everything at the Prom.
So I remember that one was a really high stage.
Yeah.
What was Dance Land?
We basically
played. I saw the Fabulous Flippers there too.
Yep.
We basically played every big ballroom really in the Midwest we hit. And there used to be a lot more then than there are today.
The Bel Ray Ballroom.
Bel Ray, we played a lot of Bel Ray.
Where's Wes? What else was there out there?
Schlieff's Little City. Don't forget about
Schlieff's,
that one.
The Purple Cigar or something.
The Purple Onion.
And then we opened up the Hullabaloo Club in St. Louis Park. When that opened up, we were the opening.
And, of course, every armory and roller rink and the planet that would have a teen dance.
Yeah. A few interesting places in Wisconsin, too.
The LBJ Ballroom in Wisconsin.
Ellsworth, Wisconsin, And,
That was Proches. Proches Popular Ballroom.
There were
one
several.
One of the cool places was where that little guy was with his wife that looked like olive oil.
No.
south of the cities?
Yeah.
You mean Nate's
Ball? Yeah.
Jewett's Point.
Yeah, so we had just started dressing differently. And, you know, we were all dressed the way we wanted to dress. We were on the stage getting ready to play, and they were letting the kids in. And there was probably about 150 kids in. It was just right at the beginning. And Nate comes up to the stage, and he goes, "Oh, when are you guys going to change your clothes?"
Into your suits.
And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You know, well, you all look the same." I go, "No, this is how we look." And he goes, "Not in my dance hall, you don't. You wear the same outfit." I said, "So you mean you don't want us to play if this is how we look?" And he goes, "Yeah." So I went and turned the bogan off. I said, "Let's go home, guys." Just like that. And all of a sudden, his wife comes running from the back of the hall going, "She looked like olive oil." That's all I remember. And she was waving her arms and she's going, "No, Nate, no. There's kids in the dance hall. They're lined up outside." So he went, "Oh," he had this big cigar. He goes,
"All right, I guess you guys can play."
Yeah.
By the way, going back to Path for a minute, I remember right after the record broke, and I was on the phone with Shapiro, and he said, "Do you have a piece of paper there?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'll get it." So I got a little piece of paper, like, you know, so I thought he was going to give me a phone number or something. And this had to be in the summer of 65, I think it was, right when the record broke. Yeah. So I thought he was going to give me a phone number. So he says, "All right, write this down. This ballroom, and we were booked every weekend until December.
That was me that called you. because I went to Dick's house. He said, come to my house, because I was two blocks away from him. I sat down in his bedroom, which was his office, and he hands me a sheet with every Jeez. Friday night, every Saturday night, half the Sunday afternoons, yep. and 2 to 3 nights during the midweek of stuff. And so I call Owen. I said, get a piece of paper. and it was like he was shot in the head.
No drugs.
Huh?
No drugs.
All right, well, get him some drugs, okay?
So the other thing...
We were booked the whole summer.
The thing to remember is...
But all the way through, like into the winter.
The High Spirits worked a lot. We played sometimes 2 or 3 gigs in a day. We even play graduation parties, all night long parties, and we would play 3 times, 4 times in a weekend. We worked a lot.
Dayton's top 10 on Saturday afternoons or something.
And you remember Saturday, playing Lake Harriet Bandstand?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we had a funny thing there because we had a funny time in Duluth, and somebody announced it on the radio to Bill Deal the next morning.
Couldn't figure out who that was.
I don't know.
And it was something we should not have been doing.
Yeah.
Now, I understand the band traveled to Kansas City on several occasions. How did you get popular down there?
Our record was
number
one on WHB down there. And so Dick had lined up a job for us. It was for $2,000. Yeah, it was $2,000.
We're getting $200 a night here.
Yeah.
A lot of money in those days.
Yeah, so we actually we played down, the first time we played down there was the night the Beatles played here.
Wow.
It was the same night. And we went down there, and it was a hot summer night. And I remember I told the guys this when we were rehearsing this week. I don't know if they remembered or not, but the opening band was playing, and we were outside just standing around because it was just, we were outside. And this cop had this big Harley, this big old Harley, and I was looking at his Harley, and I was just going, God, this is beautiful. And he goes, you want to go for a ride? And I went, yeah, sure, you know. So I hopped on the back of his Harley, and we just take off, and we're driving down the highway, and he goes, you know, the last star I gave a ride to was Eddie Fisher. So, yeah, so that was our first time in Kansas City. I think we played there 4 times.
Another big date is January 12th, 1966. The band returns to K-Bank and records your second 45. 2 songs, I Believe, written by Rick Levinson, and Bright Lights, Big City, a Jimmy Reed song. Rick Levinson, how did this song get picked to be on this record?
Ira came to a practice, and we were looking for another song to record. And we only did cover songs mostly. And the only song that anyone in the band had written and the band had learned to that point in time was this one song that I wrote. And this was a song about crushed love followed by redemption, because my girlfriend broke my heart by breaking up with me. She didn't quite know that we were going together, so I can't really blame her. And actually, years later, she married Dick Shapiro. But we're married now because Dick passed away prematurely. But anyway, so Ira says, do you have any original material? So we looked at each other, and Ludio starts off with the organ riff. And we just went into it, and Ira goes, that's great, we're recording that.
And by the way, I think... out of all the stuff we recorded, I think that that's probably the best song that we did. And I told you the story at practice, but I was on tour with some band in the 80s, and I was in Germany, and I went into a record store. And just for the heck of it, I said, have you ever heard of anything on Soma Records in Minneapolis, Minnesota? My Shirtel relative's going to own that place. And this guy lit up. He says, you mean I Believe? And all of a sudden it was like he lit up, and it, I guess it's a major collector's item. And but in my estimation, when I've listened to it myself and played it for the, you know, my kids and people in the music business that throughout the years, like, hey, I had a little 45, you know, they love that song. And you know what? I will put this directly on the Heiliger organization. They screwed up on that.
How so?
They didn't work it.
You know, a lot of stuff that happened on Soma Records happened quite by accident, because there was no... Ira was the closest thing to what we consider an A&R guy.
And they had hardly any promotion.
Amos was marketing. A tough businessman. And he was not creative. In fact, the story I heard about the Trashman was that he just laughed and threw it in the garbage can until But still, you need, for a record to happen, you need two things. There has to be a business entity and there has to be a creative entity. And when the two meet, right. No different than Phillips and, with Elvis and all. So Amos was the business entity, but they had no idea how to promote records. Things that happened by mistake, and they kind of, because they had the power of the Musicland stores, they could put the product in the stores and get it happening there too. And they had pull with the local radio stations. And by the way, the local radio stations were not programmed by these big multi-station programmers.
They're still independent.
So yeah, they were independent, and you could actually take something to a station and play it. And because I don't even think they brought Love Light out to the stations.
Also,
I think we did that.
I think they were threatened because everybody said, "I believe." You mean, "I believe for every little drop of rain that falls," and they thought that there would be some legal implication there, and they didn't want any part of that.
So I assume this record did not get the airplay that Love Light got.
No,
exactly.
Okay. Was that disappointing to you, Rick?
Hugely. This was my ticket. This was my ticket,
It was a great recording. He just got out of therapy, so let's not create anymore.
Yeah, I really love that song.
We don't want to send him back over the edge. Yeah. Come on.